What up? It's the Crossover Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today is a diehard Nets fan, a phenomenal podcaster, and he is a certified rock star. Longtime drummer for the Gaslight Anthem, Benny Horowitz. Like the band, Benny's a New Jersey guy, grew up on the Nets, obviously during their Meadowlands days. Big fan during the Jason Kidd era, the two finals appearances. He becomes a season ticket holder along the way, follows them to Brooklyn, and of course, he has experienced the high highs and the low lows of Nets fandom. And needless to say, right about now, he's pretty stoked about his team. We all know the Knicks are still New York's team and cast a big shadow, but the Nets, they're poised to win a title right now, maybe several. And so, fun time to be a Nets fan, as Benny will tell you. We get into all that, the fun of rooting for them when they were kind of the underdog, rebuilding along the way, and then kind of switching gears and having to embrace a super team that kind of got manufactured out of thin air. He had to get over his sort of disdain for James Harden along the way, learn to embrace him. So we get into all that. We preview the Nets-Bucks series starts this weekend. And of course, we had to talk a little Gaslight Anthem and music as well. Before we get to all that, a reminder to please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Hit me with any feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck. You can also find Benny Horowitz on Twitter. He is at BennyHorowitz1, that's the numeral one. And check out his two podcasts, Going Off Track and The Tune-Up. We'll tell you a little bit about those during the interview as well. Okay, coming up, a whole lot of Nets talk with Benny Horowitz, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, pleased to be joined by the co-host of the Going Off Track podcast, co-host of the Tune Up podcast. It's got a lot of podcasts going on. More importantly, the drummer for the Gaslight Anthem and season ticket holder to the Brooklyn Nets, who are now in the second round, Benny Horowitz. Benny, what's happening, my friend?
Oh, very little. Sitting in my new forest home, my friend.
Your new forest home, which I've seen photos of that you have texted. I'm jealous, especially during a year of lockdown, sitting here in my concrete jungle of Brooklyn, thinking an actual jungle would look really nice after all the months of being cooped up. I got to come visit your forest one of these days.
Yeah, I'd love to see you. Listen, I was ill-prepared for the humanity of living in a city even before all this. So once it hit, I was a shell of myself. I had to get out.
Yeah, I think you made the right move. And this is great, too, because we're doing the pod over Zoom. So I can see over your shoulder. I can see your display. There's that Twitter account that tracks people's backgrounds.
Yeah. Where am I rating, you think?
I think you're doing pretty well. You're way better than me. I've got the fake background with the bridge because my home office just it doesn't work. But you've got the color coded bookshelf, which I'm always fascinated by. I've always been a biggest to smallest, and it's not until the last few years that I realized people color code their bookshelves. So you've got that going. You got a menorah back there. Uh-huh. Nice touch. It's a good looking menorah.
Thank you.
And you've got a Cavs Kyrie Irving. You're a Nets fan, but you have a Cavs Kyrie Irving bobblehead.
Listen,
back there.
You know me, Howard. First and foremost, I'm a basketball fan, you know? And a guy like Kyrie Irving, even when he was on the Cavs, not as much when he was on the Celtics. I did support the player for just being a wildly good player, you know? It's just cool. It's cool.
He's a wildly good player.
Let's give him a little love here.
All right. There we go.
Do you have a Pepsi Max endorsement by any chance? Is that still a thing?
I was gonna say, is Pepsi Max that? I don't think that exists anymore.
I don't know. Never had that one.
Yeah. So my bobblehead collection is all in boxes, and I think the best one in there is a Chick Hearn bobblehead that the Lakers gave out when I was still covering the Lakers back in the day, and they were honoring Chick. I don't remember if this was. I think it was while he was still with us. I don't think it was after he had passed. So I have a Chick Hearn bobblehead. I've got an Isaiah Thomas, the older Isaiah Thomas, because they honored him at a Knicks Pistons game when I was covering the Knicks. So that's in a box.
When did the bobblehead begin? When did it start?
We need an oral history of the bobblehead. There's something to dig into.
Let me ask you this question. You've hung around arenas a lot. You know, those games that get canceled, but they like printed up like 20,000 towels or like, like what happens with that shit?
Well, you know, like we always hear about this after the Super Bowl, right? Where they print up T-shirts and everything for both and hats for right. both teams. And the one from the losing team like goes up. I think literally they used to say they would send it to the homeless or they send it to like Africa or some other, like they would send it off somewhere.
So there's like a city in like sub-Saharan Africa where everyone is just wearing losing Super Bowl incorrect error T-shirts.
That may possibly be the case.
Oh, good.
Which is just weird to think about. All right, you and I are recording on a Thursday morning. The Nets clinched two nights ago, beat the heck out of the Boston Celtics, which had all sorts of weird symmetry and poetic notes to it, given that the demise of the Nets started with that mega trade for Garnett and Pierce back in 2013. And given that the Celtics were supposed to have built a contender out of that trade, it's kind of gotten a little off the tracks. And of course, we are 24 hours away from the news that Danny Ainge is now stepping away from this. So your Nets have just created all kinds of havoc. There's more havoc yet to come, potentially. The Bucks loom. Benny, you've been a devoted Nets fan, season ticket holder for a very long time, predating, of course, Brooklyn, because you've been a Jersey guy for a long time. You were attending games back there. How much fun, intrigue, excitement about this Nets team versus, say, the Jason Kidd years going to the finals or the brief glimmer of whatever it was that they were trying to build here in Brooklyn before that thing went down the tubes?
Right now, I think on the scale of maybe almost 30-plus years in Nets fandom, it's coming in second, probably, to the 2000 thing. But here's where I've changed. I mean, even just as a sports fan, is like, yes, Sean Marks came in and just, to me, started doing a brilliant job, you know, taking on these bad contracts, turning players who were, you know, afterthoughts into rotational players, drafting well, and all of a sudden we wind up with this team you can't help but love. I mean, even the whole NBA loves it. Like, all of a sudden there's these upstart Nets with, like, Caris LeVert, Jared Allen, Joe Harris, Spencer Dinwiddie, you know, like all these drafted players who've come up, except for Harris, like who came up through his system, but the Nets, you know, somehow netted this guy $80 million and he was almost not on a roster at some point. So as much as that team was so much fun to root for, I'm a realistic NBA fan. I've been watching this for a long time. That team was never going to win and it was never going to win a championship. And as much as I enjoy chemistry and team building, that wasn't going to put us over the top. And I've never seen the Nets win a championship, and I'd like to. And in this league, you need these people. You need these superstars. You need the alphas to win a championship. So as much as some of these guys hurt to take in initially, I mean, I went through what every fan does, which is, you know, talking shit about people for years. And then within 2 weeks of them being on your team, you need to justify every reason why what they used to do and their former trespasses are fine now. And now you're a fan of them. So it took me a couple weeks. I got there pretty quick. And here I am. Like, I am so excited as a Nets fan. And I don't think... the fact that they're like the heels of the league is the thing that is kind of tough to wrap my head around, because it literally went from non-existent and overlooked franchise to like the heels of the league, where in the last few weeks I've heard nothing but, oh, this is a Knicks town, you know, these insecure Knicks fans going crazy. And, you know, just to you, Howard, can I state my case for the Nets?
Yeah, no, go for it. This is why you're here.
So, you know, I've been a Nets fan a long time, and let's just lay out some stats here about the Nets. Our last championship, right, is 1976 as a member of the ABA.
Yes.
The all-time leading scorer in franchise history is Brook Lopez. followed by Buck Williams. You know, I was once the owner of a Marshawn Brooks t-shirt. You know, I thought he was going to be the next guy. This is Kobe. This is New Jersey's Kobe here. So it's like the thing I want people to quickly wrap their heads around is like, listen, the Knicks are New York's juggernaut team. They're the ones who've always had the money, always had the crowds, always had the attention. And Jersey was the afterthought. Even when we were going to the finals, Jersey was the afterthought. So the idea that like this quickly, you know, all these other teams and fan bases can just like turn heel on the Nets, I don't like it. And I think you got to give people like me a pass and let me, you know, feel a little joy for like a year for my team to be in this position. And then the other thing I'd like to talk about is like, it's the same with the Warriors. And I, if you ask, you know, anyone I would talk to at the time, I stuck up for the Warriors the entire time they went through that. And my main logic was always, this was brilliant team building that allowed them to get to that point. Yes. You know, they drafted brilliantly. They drafted people at the, you know, was Draymond a second round pick?
Yes.
Yeah. And signed Steph Curry to that, you know, to that great, you know, team friendly deal, put together this great team. And that's why they were even in a position to afford Kevin Durant, even in a position to bring him in. And I think the Nets deserve like a little bit of the same credit. Like the hole that the Nets got into post the trade, as you talked about, and the fact that literally like our future was hinging on Darren Williams and Brooke Lopez, one of which had to take a buyout. I think we're still paying. and literally won maybe 60 games, you know, like in 3 years, 70 games in 3 years. And then within two seasons, redraft, trade, Sean Marks comes in. And they put themselves in a position, again, to build this team, right? Like, Jared Allen was an asset. Caris LeVert was an asset. The culture that they built, the fact that they made a playoff run, not a run, made the playoffs the couple years before, I think it all played part and parcel to the fact that Kyrie and KD were willing to come. Harden is the one that's just like the big, like, whoa, all right, I don't even know what the fuck is happening anymore.
So it's funny because, you know, I've been in this market for 17 years. I covered the Lakers for 7 years. So I saw the Lakers-Clippers dynamic there through my time there.
Right.
I've seen the Knicks and Nets dynamic here. And so much of what you're saying about the Nets tracks with the Clippers too, right? The Clippers, sad sack franchise, that's overlooked, right. Ignored in their own market, always kind of, you know, the pesky younger brother, if they're even considered at all. And same thing. Clippers had this organic kind of build, this plucky, fun team with Montrezl Harrell and Lou Williams and Pat Beverly and all these guys, and it enabled them to get Kawhi and Paul George. And immediately, the masses who were like, "Oh, look at how nice that Nets that Clipper team is building themselves up." As soon as they got the stars, and expectations came behind it, and then they flame out, and now it's everybody loves to hate the Clippers, bag on the Clippers. They're down 3-2 in the series as you and I speak right now on this pod. And the Nets, it's the same thing. They were fun and easy to kind of embrace as the underdog and as the upstart with Spencer Dinwiddie, Joe Harris, Caris LeVert, Jared Allen, all this. And there's a part of me, so I have no emotional investment, but as a basketball writer, as a fan of the game, I get caught up in that too because I think it's fun to watch the organic build, right? Like there's something about that feels very, you know, just genuine and interesting, and grafting on stars always feels like this terrible cheat code, right?
Yeah, it's like, and they deserve it if you take the slow crawl, right?
But the Clippers and Nets both earned the respect of and then the commitment of those stars at the time they got them all in that same summer, aside from the Harden piece, which came later. But it does strike me that so you root for this team, Benny. Like this team, you're living and dying with this team. It matters to you. The wins and the losses matter to you in a way that they do not matter to me. So easy for me to get, you know, sentimental and poetic about like, oh, it was such a cool thing. They had this thing going and they should have ridden it out. No, of course, when you get the chance to get the stars, you do it. But for your purposes as a fan, I always wonder, and I'll compare it to the Knicks. When the Knicks had, they first got Amari, and Amari's an import, right? But they got Amari as an import to go with Danilo Gallinari as a young guy, and Wilson Chandler and all this. And that team was really fun for a few months. And when they got Carmelo, they traded all the youth for a superstar. Yeah. And it was fun for the Garden and for Knicks fans to have this team that now had two stars, Carmelo and Amari. But there was something about that younger team that was winning for the first time at that time, you know, ending a long Knicks drought. Right. And it was a different vibe. It was a different vibe. Do you enjoy it as much? Is there some part of you that's like, man, I kind of wish there was some, like at least a little bit of it left? Because there's now, aside from an injured Spencer Dinwiddie, Joe Harris is the only member left of the plucky, rebuilding, overachieving version of the Nets. Do you miss a little bit of that? Or are you just like, no, hell with it all. We're going to win a championship, and this is all I care about at this point.
Yeah, I don't care. I don't. Listen, I'm from fucking New Jersey, man. My stadium was in a swamp, you know, until I was like 30 years old. No, I've seen a lot of plucky teams and plucky players and things like this. I'm 40 now, Howard. I want crowns. You know what I mean? Like I'm done with, like, again, I think I even said it before. Like, I loved that team. I really did. And it came from a hole that was like desperately bad. I mean, there was a point 5 years ago where I was sitting at games and going, Jesus Christ, Reggie Evans is the best fucking player on the court. Chris Humphries is the best fucking player on the court right now. You know, I was like, yo, Quincy Acey's winning us some games right now. This is reality. I'm not making it.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys have heard, you've heard this moment.
That's what I'm saying. If I could turn on the TV and see Kyrie Irving, James Harden, and Kevin Durant do work, you know, through this playoffs, I'm going to take it. The only thing I have to do, like I said, I have to intellectualize it, okay?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things that all these guys did that I don't like.
Okay, so on that, who of the three of them was the hardest for you to embrace, having already built up your impressions of them as the outsider, as you know, stars of other teams that you may not have really appreciated at the time? Who was the hardest one to embrace?
For me, it was Harden. And I think it's because, like, I've already gone through this exercise with Kyrie a little bit, even when he was in Boston. Like, I'm a born and bred punk rocker, you know what I mean? Which makes me a dissenter. So, like, the second Kyrie was going rogue and doing some of that stuff and causing this ripple, I kind of thought it was funny, you know? And I did for a while think some of it was intentional, like the flat earth thing. I think me and you even talked about it at the time. I thought it was intentional. I'm like, I've heard this guy speak. He's bright. He knows what's going on. He doesn't believe the fucking earth is flat. He hates the media. I think he's playing around. And that part of it, I actually really appreciate it. Durant, the Warriors thing bothered me a little at first, but then the second I watched them play basketball, I got over it because it was just such a beautiful thing to watch, and I really enjoyed it. The only thing I didn't like about those teams was the fact that I pretty much knew who was going to win the finals before the season started. You know, that was my issue there. But the longer Durant goes on, personally, some of the things I think, I almost think Durant was a bit of a trailblazer. And some of the things that he talks about and tackles now, the league has culturally grown into. So this way that, like, you can take the fact that Kevin Durant's burner accounts were the fact that he's, like, whiny or that he needs to get in there or something. I take it as Kevin Durant is, like, a deeply sensitive person who actually views himself as a normal enough person that he'll talk to someone online.
Yeah.
Be like, yo, fuck you. I'm right here. Like, this is what we're saying. And even though his tact is pretty awful sometimes and he sounds like an asshole, the actual engagement of it, I'm like, all right. And I do the same thing. I get called out on Twitter by someone or like my band or something. And all of a sudden I'll pop into that feed. I'll be like, motherfucker, like, here I am. like here I am. Do you want to actually say what you were going to say? And I know it's like the closest we can come to being, you know, to having like bravado online, I guess. But I do think, like, over the years, you know, maybe, you know, with Kevin Love and a couple of the other players and even someone like, you know, like Delonte West, like what if that situation, what if he was in the league now? Yeah. you know, that could have been dealt with a lot differently. That guy might have not wound up on the path. So there is a part of Durant's thing that I find like kind of intriguing in the idea that I do think he's like pretty deep and pretty sensitive. And I kind of like dig that because it makes him a little bit of a person.
It definitely does. And I'm with you on that. I would rather think that the players do care what fans think, right? Now, there's a lot of trolling out there. And so you always got to be cautious about responding to somebody. You're responding earnestly to a critique or a criticism that may not even be earnest in itself because it may just be somebody just like trying to just mess with you. But I respect the fact that Kevin Durant cares enough to engage, whereas a lot of people in that position, whether they're athletes, whether they're celebrities of other sorts, musicians, actors, are so above it all, you don't matter to me. At least this guy's telling you, know what, I think about this stuff. And if he comes off as defensive or if he comes off as whatever, he at least is showing that there is a thought process there and an engagement that he cares to engage and that the fans matter on some level. So I mean, I'd rather it be with his regular account, his actual account, than the burners. That was one. Right. That's one little chapter that people will always attach to him. But I'm with you, Benny. I prefer that an athlete or celebrities actually care as opposed to just being above it all. You know.
Yeah, me too. And then with Harden, I mean, he couldn't be the absolute opposite. And I think that's one of the reasons I have a hard time is like I don't know who James Harden is. At all. You know what I mean? I don't know what kind of guy he is. I don't know what his life is like besides for the rumors that he loves to stay out all night. Also don't care. You know what I mean? Like you're rich and young and you're in a city and you're still putting up 40 points. Do whatever the fuck you want at night. Like I could care less. But I think I just don't connect with him as a person because he's never shown someone, especially on my side, which is, you know, totally detached from having access to these people. I just don't know.
Yeah.
So I love his game and fuck. I mean, I could watch him play all day. I think, you know, his game itself took a lot of shit in Houston. And I think we were kind of disregarding the fact that like, this is how they crafted that entire team. And like the way he was playing, holding on to the ball, you know, 16, 20 seconds, every possession with, you know, four guys spaced out around the corners, which obviously anybody who loves watching basketball, to me, the beautiful game, like this is not a beautiful basketball. It's like you said earlier, it's a cheat code. You know, he figured out the new rules, the way people defend on the perimeter. And I'm this big and I can shoot so well. And this is how I figured it out. So I appreciate that part of it. I didn't necessarily like watching it in Houston, but the second it showed up in New York, it looked a lot fucking different to me. And all of a sudden, James Harden was a facilitator again, and he's looking for people, and he's obviously this, you know, savant of a basketball guy when he's on the floor. So quickly, I kind of turned again with his game, and I'm sort of right back on the train.
It's interesting, too, right? Like, you knew that James Harden had the skills to do everything that he's doing right now, and it was always just a question of what did he want to do, and what was he willing what trade-offs would he make? And he made them, like, to his credit.
That's
absolutely
right.
He made him, but I'm with you. Like, I would much rather have watched, you know, the Warriors. And yes, there was an inevitability there, and I'm with you on that too. Like, there was a little bit of like, okay, we know what the outcome of all this is, but still, there's such a blast to watch. And it was there. They were about ball movement, and the Rockets were about Harden pounding the living crap out of the ball. And was that the Rockets? Was that you know the way they constructed it? Was it what Mike D'Antoni wanted? Was it what James Harden wanted? Was it what Chris Paul wanted? Because the two of them would just trade off as ISO guys.
Right.
And so you don't know until a guy's in a different context what other version of him you might see. Is this him? Is this just the context of the team he's with? And so that has been one of the great things about this transition and what has been fun when those three have actually played together, which is still like what, less than
a whopping
200 games?
Regular season minutes.
Like, yeah, I don't know games, where maybe?
But
when they're at their full strength, like that's, you know, you don't have to be a fan of the Nets. They're spectacular to watch offensively. And this version of Harden is way more enjoyable than the Houston version.
For sure.
So it's okay to come around on that and say like, no, now I like watching him because it is a different version. He's not just pounding the crap out of the ball. The ball moves.
Yeah.
kind of matters.
I just thought of, a funny musical analogy for the Nets right now as we were talking, which is like let's take, you know, like an all-star band, right? Like you take individually each of the best members from four great bands and put them in one band and you just throw them on stage for the first time. Like when they're playing the actual song itself, it's probably going to be great because they each are so masterful at their parts. They'll be fine. The thing that's going to be weird is going to be between songs. Hmm. You know, they're not going to know what to do. They're all going to be tuning separately. They don't know their nuances. Singer's going to be looking back at the drummer like, are we going? Are we going? We're going. Okay, we're going.
Are we on three, you know, or are we on four?
Like, yeah, like all that rookie shit. So the actual song itself will be fine. But all these little like minutia gray areas that take chemistry and time will be weird. And I think the Nets might be the same way. It's like when you're within 24 seconds on the offensive side of the ball, I don't know, I'm going to be fine. But it's the parts of basketball that need a little minutia and chemistry that they're going to struggle with, which is probably defense.
Well, and this is why I've been a longtime skeptic ever since the Harden trade. You know, there was the, you know, lack of familiarity and then the lack of playing time together. All the players that went out and all that. I was worried about the depth for a while, but they've rebuilt the depth really amazingly, right? Yeah. Like the fact that guys like Brown and Mike James, who, you know, just like was plucked out of, you know,
that guy appear from. Oh my goodness.
Even the Blake Griffin element, like guys who did not start the season, Nick Claxton, guys who either didn't start the season on the roster or didn't start the season in the rotation, who are now key pieces, and it all somehow looks like it works. But here's where I'm still intrigued and slash skeptical as they go into this second round series against the Bucks. The Bucks have the continuity. The Bucks have been together. The core group has been together. They grafted on Drew Holiday, but he's had a full season with them. They bring in PJ Tucker at midseason, but their core group has been together for a few years now and been great together. They know what they do defensively. They know what they do offensively. They know what they're about. And the Nets, you can't say that about. And so there's this ultimate test here of some of our long-held beliefs and cliches, which is chemistry is important and time together, and you got to go through some duress and situations. And as you said, 24 seconds, fine. They can do anything. Last few seconds of the shot clock, and also in the last couple of minutes of the game. Now we're in your analogy of the what happens when the all-star band is between songs.
There we go.
Yeah, and you're looking back at the drummer going, are we going on one, or is it one, two, three, go, or going on three? So, I don't know what that's going to mean. Like, we beating up on the Celtics, the depleted, injured, kind of screwy, we had a weird season Celtics does not prove anything yet. Yeah. Right. So this Bucks series to me is like the first real test since these guys got together. Fair?
Totally fair. Yeah. I mean, like, I think in that last game, we saw 38 minutes of Romeo Langford. So no, I'm not taking it very seriously. I mean, I thought we were going to, you know, drown that series, you know, even before I knew Jaylen Brown was going to be out for the season or Robert Williams wasn't going to play, like, who, you know, game one, I'm like, oh my God, Robert Williams is, you know, Dikembe Mutombo over here. I'm like, what is happening? I don't think it was a fair indication. I think the only fair indication of that series was watching that they have like zero answers for someone like Jason Tatum, which means they probably have very few answers for a bunch of the guys on the Bucks. So I am concerned about this series. And I mean, I think everyone is, and I'm getting to the point where, you know, I think Embiid has a meniscus tear now and AD looks so slow, I'm starting to wonder if this is the finals. I mean, these might be the two best teams in the NBA. Something happened in the Miami series that scares me even more. Now, I know it was like a small piece. I watched a lot of those games. I didn't think Miami stood a chance, really. Like, they just didn't look like they had it this season, and kind of a shell of whatever that bubble situation was going. So I didn't think it was an indication basketball wise, but towards the end of the series, when it was getting away from Miami and they knew it, they were going to help me with the pronunciation.
Bielica.
Yeah. So they're going to him a lot because they just needed someone to hurl up a bunch of threes and try to get back in the game. And at one point, he went in strong. he made a layup or something, and he fucking stepped over Giannis. And I'm even watching on TV. I'm like, come on, dude. Like, you just came from the Kings. You're basically Myers Leonard. Like, stop it. What are you doing? So I'm even mad on the other side. And who do I see? First thing, Bobby Portis comes over, stiff arms him, gets him out of Giannis's way. Giannis has a chance to get up. And I'm like, whoa, 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 that's different. That's new. You know what I mean? On that team. Like, and again, this is all anecdotal. I'm just a fan of the league. But to me, Giannis seems like someone that means a lot to. You know, he seems like someone who is like ride or die with his team, wants it to be like family, you know? And when he has guys like this, you know, Bobby Portis being like, hey, I'll make you Mirotić right now. If you don't stop fucking around, you know, I'm going to Mirotić you. Anyone could take that. I just came up with it.
I like it.
But I think that's big. And I think, you know, PJ Tucker out there for 15 minutes is big. And then so I think they're a different team than we're used to seeing. And I think they're a lot tougher and more cohesive. And I think they're going to score a million fucking points. I have a feeling, actually, that one of like game one or game two, I think, is going to be an absolute spanking, where the Nets lose by a considerable amount. I think there's going to be a game in this series like that. But on the other hand, I do think there are going to be games that they can do nothing on defense against the Nets. And the Nets are clearly capable of going like 130, 140 plus. It's a lot of games. I like the Nets bench a little bit better. I like their depth. I like when, you know, two of Milwaukee's big three are out and the Nets can manage to get two of theirs in. I think we have like a really big advantage in lineups like that. But I don't know, man. This is going to be a tough one. Where are you at with this? Did you make a prediction yet?
I've not made any predictions yet. It's going to be it's somebody in seven, right? Like if I could go somebody in nine, I'd pick somebody in nine, right? Like this thing's go. It may go like overtime of game seven, triple overtime of game seven. Like I think it could be that kind of series where it's just trading haymakers. And when the Nets are all on, they're impossible to stop. I don't know if the Nets can do much to stop the Bucks. So I think one of the biggest intrigues going into this, right, is like who's guarding Giannis most of the time. And I was lining this up so Drew and Kyrie are going to probably guard each other. That's pretty simple. Middleton and Harden seems obvious. Connaughton and Harris, because the white guys, it's a requirement. It's an unwritten rule. So then you've got on one side left, you've got Brooke Lopez and Giannis, and then you've got presumably Blake Griffin and Kevin Durant. Is Jeff Green healthy and you put Jeff Green back in the starting lineup?
Yeah.
You're probably not starting Claxton against this group. He's a little skinny to be taking on Brooke Lopez.
Not yet.
So it's
not
probably yet. Blake Griffin, right? And the natural it thing is. Would be to have Blake. He's got the muscle to just kind of bang on Brooke Lopez. And it's so like, it's like, even though you wouldn't necessarily want to put Durant on Giannis or vice versa initially, because both teams are going to try to keep their guys out of foul trouble. And maybe you save that for late in the game. But I don't know if there's any alternative. Like, what else are you going to do unless there's just some severe disadvantages if you try this any other way?
No, I think you're right. I think it's an inevitability that Durant's going to wind up on Giannis. I mean, I think we're going to get some DeAndre Jordan sightings. He's going to pop out and get physical for, you know, 12, 15 minutes. I would love to see Jeff Green come back, but it doesn't look like he is. And they were sort of solely using Jeff in those small ball lineups. Which I think he could be really effective, especially on offense. You know, I keep waiting. You know, Brooke Lopez is a tricky one for me. You know, this is my guy.
You Brooke still got Lopez some love for like, Brooke Lopez.
Oh, I got a lot of love for Brooke Lopez. I mean, that is like the most loyal Nets soldier there's ever been. I mean, he was on the junkiest of teams, like the
12-70.
And Brooke Lopez literally never said a bad word.
Yeah.
You know, right? Like, I watched that guy intently for years, and he usually came with a smile, and he was fun, and he always came hard. And I love Brooke Lopez. But I have been waiting for him to slow down a little bit. And I do think when the Nets get out on a break or something like that, I really think Brooke could find himself a little more trivialized in this series than some other players, especially when they start to go small. So I think they actually have the potential to expose Brook a little bit with the way that the Nets can stretch out the floor, and it might force them to take him out a little bit.
Brook Lopez is the answer to a question that I was going to ask, but I've inverted this now, and I've ruined the premise.
You're a pro.
I'm so good at this. 2014 was the last time your Nets made the second round of the playoffs. Last time they won a series. That was the Pierce KG year with Jason Kidd as coach. That's the last time they made the second round. There's only one player from that Nets roster who's even still in the NBA.
Oh my God.
And that would be the aforementioned Brook Lopez.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look at that. That was a young team, youthful squad out there.
Well, I mean, but it's funny. Okay, of course, like it's like, well, duh, Pierce and Garnett. Well, yeah, they were at the end, but a lot of that team wasn't that old. Everybody from that roster, I looked it up before we started. Everybody from that roster, aside from Brook Lopez, is gone. And Brook Lopez at that time would have been the one you would have thought might have had the shortest shelf life because he was still not that far removed from all those foot surgeries. People were worried that he might not play much longer. Like teams were scared off. Every time he was going to free agency, it was like, oh, do you really want to pay this guy? So fascinating that all these years later, Brook is the one guy still playing.
I know.
And that he's a completely reinvented version of himself. Like it's just, it's
wild.
It is wild. It is wild.
I think I wrote a tweet a couple weeks ago that literally no one cared about. it was the fact that like Brook and Robin Lopez out of the same draft class are two of the only people in the top 20 of that draft class who are still active, functional NBA players. And who would have thought at the time that the twin Stanford Towers were going to be the ones to come out with the lengthiest career and actually be integral pieces on playoff teams? Like, I wouldn't have guessed that.
That's kind of wild. So you mentioned like Brook got your Nets through a lot of the lean years, and you're right. He was always the loyal soldier. He was giving it all out there. It reminded me of this. So the 12-70 season, I hate to bring up old bad memories, but
it's okay.
2009-10, the Nets go 12-70. Like there were so many weird things about that year. Kiki Vandeweghe being forced to coach the team and all this stuff. Yeah. It was just like a lot of weird stuff. And they're still at the Meadowlands in a half empty building. I did a feature for the Times. I was at the New York Times at that point, and I was mostly covering the Knicks still, but I did a feature on, do you remember the hype man? Marco Glorious G. Kahare. He was like...
He's the old Nets super fan.
He was like this 25-year-old kid. He's got... It says Glorious G, I think, on the back of his jersey. Yeah. And he had the microphone, and he was trying to hype up the crowd. And, like, you couldn't hype up that crowd because there was very little crowd there. And the team was, like, historically terrible. And, man. But here's the other thing I remember about that season, Benny. Because I watched a bunch of those games in person. At the end of every Nets game... Just like a lot of teams, you go to like the final buzzer and then the music comes on. They were playing the 59 sound by the Gaslight Anthem, by your band. You do you remember this?
No, I didn't know the Nets ever gave us love.
I swear.
I would have used that in my approach to getting season tickets because I've been awful at flexing my weight. I mean, my ticket guy just thinks I'm some dude. So maybe this will help. Hey, Justin, here I am on Howard Beck's podcast. Give me that half court shit, you know?
So there's two possibilities here, by the way. This happened this whole time and you never noticed, or I have like completely I'm just delusional. And this is just some weird like grafting of memories. But I swear to God, there was a bunch of those games where they were losing because I was covering part of the losing streak at the beginning of the season where they lost 16 in a row or whatever it was. And they would end, and it's just like, you know, the Garden has their, you know, New York-themed songs or whatever. Billy Joel comes on, and other stuff comes on. The Lakers, when they win, it's always I Love L.A. comes on. And the Nets were using 59 Sound, which at the time, one, you guys had just hit it big at that, you know, this is right in your early peak there after that album comes out. You're riding that wave, and you're a New Jersey band, so it makes some sense, and it's a hard-driving, great, upbeat sound, but the song is about like death and tragedy and a car accident and like it's a really mournful, like if you're listening to the lyrics, I'm not sure that actually made sense, or maybe it in a twisted way did make sense for that Nets team to have playing at the end of every, so I just had to throw this at you because I'm curious your thoughts.
Do you think maybe it was like a drunk driving thing? You know,
don't maybe they were like, on the
people
way home.
Are at the stadium. They probably had a couple beers. Let's play a song about someone dying in a car accident. Just give them that like Eddie and the Cruisers feel, you know what I mean? Make sure you don't do it.
Eddie and the Cruisers.
I mean, the only relation I can think is, you know, the New Jersey Devils have been using the song Howl as their goal song for years. So when they score a goal, we play in the stadium, which is one of the coolest things ever. And the only thing I can think is maybe it got connected the 2 years that the Nets were at Prudential Center before Brooklyn, because they were playing in the same arena as the Devils. But this was pre that. This was back in the swamp.
I have a very vivid memory of sitting there in press row on the baseline, you know, down the way from where the Nets bench is. You know, writing or whatever, and hearing the song on, because like that album came out. I freaking loved that album, of course. And loved the song, and I would just notice it in the background. Now I'm on Deadline pounding away, but I would notice it in the background. And it's the kind of thing that these things get ingrained in your head, even if you're not really paying that close of attention, because you're sitting there at courtside on Deadline. You know, we got like 3, 4, 5 minutes to finish up, hit send, and then run back to the locker rooms, get interviews, and go right all over again. And so it's always in the background, but it's like that's how it gets ingrained, because it's that's a moment that I always am really locked in, but you're still kind of semi-conscious of what's going on around you and the noise or the vibe. And so, yeah, I never got a chance to ask anybody like, how did that get picked? But I just thought it was appropriate. And yet at the same time, a kind of a twisted choice. But,
yeah. Strange.
Right.
Strange. Yeah. I think so. I maybe would have went with Frank Sinatra or something.
there are probably other choices now. And now, of course, everything is, Brooklyn hip hop and a lot of Brooklyn themed stuff. So anything, the New Jersey part of it, do you feel nostalgic for that part of it at all? Like, you're a New Jersey guy, you're still a big Brooklyn or a big Nets fan, and you're a Brooklyn Nets fan now. You go to all the games, you make the big trek. Is there anything about that New Jersey existence of the Nets that you could even possibly be nostalgic for? I mean, I guess the Jason Kidd years, clearly.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe, you know, you've had the laminate pass into stadiums for so many years that there might be something you forget. Is that being a fan of a really successful team is actually harder than being a fan of a shitty team. You know, like, so there was like, you know, even though the Nets were bad, and I was going to like desperately see the development of like Nenad Krstić. You know, I was taking my own car to an arena with no people at it. I believe the deal they used to have was the upper half of the upper level sold $8 seats across the board, maybe 10, but they had like a, basically a deal. And there were times when that stadium was like, the upper level was like full more towards the top because of this ticket deal they used to have.
Right. The back two rows are the only ones that are full.
Yeah. Like, I never even had to take the tunnel because there's so few cars. You know, like when you go to a concert at the Meadowlands, you got to park in Sea Caucus, take the pedestrian tunnel over, you know, or the pedestrian overpass. Like, you didn't have to do that for Nets games because you're parking right next to the stadium. So I did, you know, like, I appreciated that. Like, there's kind of that underdog, we always suck kind of thing. And I think that is one of the reasons why you mentioned it before, why the Jason Kidd thing was such a coup when it happened, because we were just coming off like really, really awful, desperate era of Nets basketball. I mean, there was what, like the mid 90s with Butch Beard, you know, the late 90s with Calipari. I got some numbers for you for this interview.
All right.
The Nets went 69 and 177 from 15 to 17. Oh, that's not pertinent in this case, but like, And then we had these Stephon Marbury years where, like, you know, you were kind of like lulled into the fact that you had a superstar, but you were like never winning games again. And I'll literally like never forget the morning when I woke up and Jason Kidd was traded to the Nets. I believe it was late June of like 01. I just woke up. You know, those were the days where like there wasn't social media, so there wasn't like any chatter about it. as a fan, I had no idea this was coming. I was a huge Jason Kidd fan anyway, from college and from his early pro career. And that was like, that's a feeling that maybe like you'll never get again because of the fact that it was so bad for so long, you know? So those 2000s teams, those early ones that went to two finals, even though you never really thought we were going to win one because, you know, we're going up against like Shaq Kobe Lakers and the Duncan Spurs and like these all-time great teams that I was never sure we would get past, but it felt really good. And that's where maybe you asked that question earlier, like which era feels the best. And when you're that bad for that long and you start to score that stuff and it's still in New Jersey and it's still yours, it was probably a little more special. I was also in my early 20s and I was just like ripping it, you know, going to games and no responsibilities, you know, different story too. I was floating then. Now I got to bring kids to games and get up to take shits and buy Knishes and stuff, you know?
No doubt. I don't know how much basketball you played as a kid, but I
never told you I invented point forward.
You invented point forward. Well, yeah. Hold on. Yeah, I've seen you in person. You do not have the height for a forward unless you would like it, unless your growth spurt was when you were like seven and you were like the point forward for your 7-year-old's team.
Well, yeah, in Central Jersey church leagues and shit like that, I was a point forward.
So you were Giannis Giannis.
I always said I was a little like Rodney Rogers-esque. These days with a little revisionist history, let's go a little more Lamar Odom.
I like that. Well, Lamar Odom was on this on this very podcast just a couple weeks ago.
I saw some of that. Yeah.
Are you so? What position is the drummer on a basketball court?
Oh, definitely. Like, it's interesting you say that because I've thought about this a lot. In baseball, we are certainly catchers.
Huh.
See, the thing with basketball is like, what would you say is the like most necessary, not most necessary, but the piece on a basketball team where if it goes away, it all falls apart?
Right.
Is it like your defensive cog, your big man, your rim protector?
I keep thinking point guard because in the same way that the drummer sets the structure for the band, the rhythm, the timing, everything else, the point guard does all that, except that in the NBA, it depends on the team, right? If Chris Paul's your point guard, Chris Paul's the drummer. But if Chris Paul's on a team with Kevin Durant, but then is Kevin Durant more like the lead singer, but like kind of like the Jim Morrison, like I don't really want to be the lead singer. I don't want people to notice me.
Yeah, he's like the broody lead singer. Maybe he plays a guitar too, but he is a front man.
Because the front man, the singer is always we always think of as the star or representative of the band, right? That's how these things go. And in the NBA, it doesn't matter which position that is. If that guy's the star of your team, that's the lead singer.
Right. Well, maybe this is it. So maybe it's a point guard, but it's not an offensive-minded point guard. Andre Miller. Maybe like a Rajon Rondo in his prime. You know, people like that. Give me Jason Kidd.
Yeah.
That was the ugliest three-point shot I've ever seen, even though he started to hit it late in his career. So, maybe that's good. I'd say the distributor point guard, but not Dame Lillard or something.
Right.
You know, like, drummers aren't stepping back from like 33 feet.
Right. And not the Russell Westbrook version either, because if that were the case, like all you would hear would be the drums.
No.
You would never
sloppiest drummer
you would hear
ever.
No guitar. Yeah. You would hear no bass. It would just be drums.
Drummer can't average 5 turnovers plus a game, Howard. You know, got to be a lot more careful with the ball. Pick and choose your spots.
All right.
You know?
So we've settled on this. You're not a point forward. You're Rajon Rondo.
I'll take it.
It's not bad.
Not anymore. Give me Celtics Rondo.
Or Kidd. You know what? Jason Kidd was the right one because you're a Nets guy.
Even though Jason Kidd now, this is the classic separation of what we were talking about earlier, which is like, I don't want to know anything about that guy as a man. You know what I mean? Like Jason Kidd I've loved and lost Jason Kidd like more than like relationships in my life. I've loved and lost him at least 3 times, you know?
Yeah.
So,
And the last one was kind of a bad breakup. The last one,
dirty breakup. So I don't think I'm willing to get on that wave again with Jason Kidd. I don't think I can emotionally handle it, Howard.
All right, here's my other tortured rock star slash NBA star mix-up analogy, mashed-up analogy.
Okay. All right.
You got your band, the Gaslight Anthem, breaks through in 2008 with the 59 sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's
say
like
a breakthrough around then. Yeah.
Right. That was the one that really put you guys on the map. A lot of airplay, ton of touring behind that, everything else. And then as often happens in the music business, like you guys have a bunch of great albums behind that, but like the breakthrough moment is the one that people remember. And that album is the one that people will, you know, that the average fan remembers more, right? Like there's this, and I think about with NBA teams sometimes, like the Durant, Harden, Westbrook, Ibaka, Thunder, there's that moment and you think that's what it's going to be like forever. Does it feel like that as a band? Like you have like the big album and it's not that you guys haven't been successful after that. Great success. And you have other projects, other bands too. But I wonder, is there something different about like the first time and the time when like you're at your peak and in your youth and you have this moment? And for NBA teams, I think like, all right, well, as it happens, you don't get to necessarily map out the same thing over and over again, right?
Right.
You know, unless you're U2 or unless you're LeBron. I don't know.
And to both of their credit, they both had to reinvent their games to keep a career going.
Is this tortured analogy making any damn sense? Is there something to this?
No, it does. Yeah, the thing that's interesting, I think, is like, yes, we were aware of it during the time. And I think that was one of the fortunate things for us with being a little older, having a bunch of, you know, to us, what would have been abject failures before that, where when it was happening, luckily, like we had the immediate knowledge that it was special, you know, and it wasn't taken for granted at the time. So I think with that being said, if you keep your eyes open and you're a conscious enough person, there are more than enough like cautionary tales throughout the history of music and or sports to know what to and not to do. But I think the interesting thing about what you said, especially in conjunction with sports, is like, what are you trying to be? Now, like Gaslight Anthem could have very easily been a band who just kept putting out records every 2 years and sustained our career and been able to tour. And it probably would have been much easier for everyone's personal lives if that is what we decided to do. But that wasn't the intention of the band from the start. And we needed to stay focused on the fact that like just eking out a year to year career out of something creative that's supposed to be inspired for yourself and other people is not going to do it. And I think that's where the reflection in sports is interesting, because, you know, you can have a 31-year-old player who's going for their, let's say, third contract, right? And they'll choose a team where they know they can get up 20 shots a game, keep their numbers up with no chance of winning, right? With no chance of doing anything great ever again. But they're fine. They're fine. They just want to keep playing. They just want to stay in the game and they just want to collect their last paycheck. And, you know, to us, I think we were like the people who are like, you either got to like reinvent the game or step away from it for a little while until you have something special to offer again, you know? So I think in the terms of sports, I think that's where you'd see it. And you see a lot of bands do it these days. And honestly, I don't think it's the prettiest look sometimes when, you know, bands are, I don't want to say rehashing because that's very dismissive to the art that other people are making. But I think a lot of people are happy staying in a 2-year record cycle every year, doing their tours, using the records as a vehicle to tour, knowing that the songs you wrote 25 years ago are the only ones people want to hear when you get out there. And they're fine with it, you know, because it's still sustaining and they're keeping their business going. And I fully respect that. But I don't know. Maybe I just enjoy a kick to the balls too much. I really believe in music. I really believe in art. I believe in the process. of making it the right way and only delivering things like that that really have something behind it. And, you know, I don't speak for everyone, but I think that's where the difference came in.
Yeah. No, that's a phenomenal answer to my very tortured and meandering question. So thank you. Thank you for saving me from my own not quite fully thought out thought process. But no, it does. It hits me at times. Like I just because I think of as a writer, I think of people's everything is in story arcs. Right. So I'm always thinking about like the rise and fall of a player, a team. And so I can't help but when I think about, you know, music and other industries too, where it's just like, there are always these moments that are different than the rest. May come at the beginning of a career, may come in the middle, whatever. And how do you internalize those, and how do you think about them, you know, as a reference point for the rest of your career, right? I covered the Lakers for 7 years at the beginning of my NBA writing career, and I got to cover 3 straight championships with Shaq and Kobe. And in the midst of it, right, I don't really know or appreciate exactly what it is that I'm experiencing as a reporter and writer covering that team. I'm just trying to write a decent story each night. I'm just trying to get to deadline without getting right, my head chopped off and somebody yelling at me.
Yeah, right.
And without Shaq and Kobe killing me the next day for something I wrote. And then it's only later that I can look back and go like, you know, now like I see Robert Ori or I see Rick Fox or I see some of the other reporters where we covered that. We have this odd shared experience of having gone through that. And I look at it much differently now through the lens of nostalgia and time than when I was in the midst of it. And again, a tortured analogy.
You see it as more special now.
Yes.
View it as that.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah.
In a weird way. So anyway, yeah. I was fascinated by that. Last quick note here as I'm my last tortured observation of linking sports and music. So I got a chance to see you guys. You did the 10-year tour to celebrate the 59 Sound in 2018. My family and I got to see you guys in Dublin. That was phenomenal. And having been to a bazillion concerts in my life, but having usually like other people, you just sit there and you just watch the whole stage presentation, or if there's other, you know, pyrotechnics going on, whatever, you don't really focus right, in on individual band members, but small venue. And I know you, and you were kind enough to get us in. Thank you. Even with my daughter being underage, still one of the great heists there that we got her in when she was like probably 7 years too young to be in that venue.
Yeah, it's Dublin.
They don't care. and I'm watching you because I have a connection to the band in this case. I know Benny, so I'm watching you on the drums. Man, you work your freaking ass off. Like I don't really. It seems obvious after the fact that a rock drummer would obviously that's a workout, but. That looked exhausting, and I don't think I'd ever really locked in on that before, thinking about it in that regard. So, I don't know if there's is there a pregame workout for the drummer for a rock band? Is there conditioning program? Because mostly we think about drummers as being kind of the screw ups. Not in your case, you're obviously in great shape. I know you're a vegetarian, you take good care of yourself, but there has to be some prep there just to get through like 90 minutes of just drumming your ass off.
Yeah, there's a huge element to it. And I think it's, again, since we're in a sports podcast, you could definitely make the connection there between watching the people who have a lot of talent, but also know how to handle their day-to-day situation and the people who don't. You know, like you've watched people like eat their way out of the league. You've watched people drink their way out of the league, even though they were talented. Yeah. Like, there is just a component to it. And I think you quickly learn, like it came up through the punk rock scene and, I got used to, all right, we're playing for 25, 30 minutes and we're playing 9 songs and it's just this burner kind of thing. And then I kind of had this opportunity to just sort of like, caffeinate my way through something or just kind of like, push my way through something. And then Gaslight starts performing these shows that are getting up to like 2 hours long, 27 songs, 29 songs, and you do quickly learn that there's an element to it. I was kind of forced into the fact to know there's an element to it because I have a chronic neck condition, knee condition, like all this stuff from playing drums. I literally have nothing in between 2 of the vertebrae in my neck and have like a chronic condition as a result. And so the thing I learned was, I think I spent a couple tours kind of pulling like a Jokic, or a Shaq, where, you know, I would like show up on tour, I'd play, I would make sure I knew the material, but from a physical element, I worked my way into shape, you know, like where I would like be, you know, not feeling as good the first show. And by like show seven, I'm like, all right, I'm straight. And then it hit a point where like, I started to really feel like a personal responsibility in the idea that like, you know what, you're charging people 20, 30, 40 bucks to come see your show. Why should the person in Milwaukee on show one get some fucking bullshit version of you when like seven shows later in Seattle, you're killing it. They all paid the same thing. You know, there could have been someone in Milwaukee who was at their first show, their last show. You know what I mean? Like, there's a good chance, like, every single show you play could have this, like, pivotal moment for someone. You just don't know. So the idea that, like, you should check out of any of them started to really offend me. So I took the idea of almost, like, using sports. I've even thought about Kobe Bryant a lot, like, when I'm getting ready for tours, where I'm just like, all right, like, get ready. Like, you're ready. Like, and I want, like, game one, hit one, to be like just as good as the last. And what do I need to do to get that going? So I did learn about that. And what's funny is I'm currently in the process of training because I, you know, like anyone, I took on some interesting habits during the pandemic, especially, you know, when I thought like I might be like, you know, packing my kids in a car and heading to Tijuana or something at some point. Like I didn't know what was going on. So, you know, I did a little scotch drinking early on, you know, I curbed that. You know, fills in with some eating, not going to gyms anymore, which I used to go to. I moved out of the city where I'm walking everywhere. And so, you know, some bad habits started to settle in. Mercy Union starts kicking up the tires again. We're like, yo, let's get something going. Let's start practicing. And shit, man, I was out of shape, like just straight up out of shape. Like I started playing drums and it felt noodly, you know, where it just like wasn't hitting hard and wasn't snapping. And it took, you know, a good like month of just like really watching myself again and playing every day to feel like I'm strong enough and capable enough to go record a record. And, you know, in 3 weeks we're going to record a new album and I'm, you know, finally starting to get to the point where I feel it again. So, you know, for my long-winded answer to your question, yeah, there's like a huge physical element to it. And I think after like 30, you're almost given the decision, right? You have to go Lemmy or Sting. You have no choice. Like you either got to go full in on like, I'm a cokehead alcoholic and that's what fuels me through this. And hopefully I don't die before I'm 50, or you got to go the way of Sting. You got to clean up your act a little, learn some tantric, you know, like, you know, get into world music, have sex for 7 hours at a time if you can, but yeah, it doesn't seem like there's a middle ground. And I will definitely say, I mean, people in a real like hardcore full-time bands, there are some like, there are some crazy athletes in there. People who like are really hardcore runners, hardcore workout people just to stay up. I mean, to imagine someone who's holding a guitar and singing for 2 hours, like that takes wind.
Yeah.
You know, you need cardio. You need that stuff to get through. So yeah, it's definitely an element of it. As much as I wish it wasn't.
There you go, folks. Rock stars are athletes. Rock stars are athletes. Don't ever get it twisted.
Drummers.
Well, drummers are definitely
athletes. Guitar player could fucking shuffle out there drunk whenever he wants.
They could just sit up. Right. They could sit on a chair. Yeah. They're like the DH.
Yeah. They could lean back.
You know,
yeah. Like
John Kruk just kind of, you know, hanging out.
Yeah. They're like practice. Yeah. Practice. No.
Well, this has been great, man. I'm glad we finally got to do this. Thank you for spending the time. I can't wait to see what happens with your Nets. I'm still rooting for a Gaslight Anthem reunion tour again or a new album. If you want to break any news on this podcast before we go.
Not today.
Not today.
Friend. Not today.
Maybe the next one. I look forward to the new Mercy Union project, though. That'll be great. Get quick plug for your two podcasts that people can find. What is, tell people in a nutshell what Going Off Track covers and what the Tune-Up covers.
Going Off Track is a long time music and entertainment podcast. So we do long form interviews with musicians and comedians and stuff like that. You know, you've known me a little while. I don't really like surface topical issues. So the quickest I can get into like death and spirituality and the fucked up journey that brought people from A to B, that's usually what that podcast is about. So it's literally going off track. And then the new one is called The Tune Up, which I do with co-host Denny Gallagher, who you know. And that's me taking a stab at sports and pop culture. And it's a lot of fun to do. It's like kind of a Jalen and Jacoby talking head sort of thing. I'd like to view myself as some version of Jalen Rose, who's on a short list now of people I'd just love to hang out with, you know?
It's good, dude.
And so, yeah, he seems great. So those are the podcasts. Easy to find, Going Off Track and Tune Up. And, yeah, new Mercy Union record will be recorded in 3 weeks. I'm looking forward to it. And I don't know when it'll be out, but soon enough, a couple months after that. And the new songs are great. I mean, I'm really starting to get jazzed up to go in there.
Excellent. I'm psyched
good
for that.
Plugging? I'm bad at plugging.
No,
you know?
No, that was good. That was good plugging. You hit all the right spots. Okay. I'm jacked for the new album, and I'm just for live music coming back too. I've bought some concert tickets already for down the road here, and some other stuff that's coming up soon.
Nice.
If Mercy Union plays, I'll be there. If the Gaslight Anthem decided, you know, just for the heck of it, come play like a little club in Brooklyn, you know, just let me know. Benny Horowitz.
I'll give you a call.
This has been fantastic, my friend. Thanks again.
Thanks, Howard. I appreciate it for sure.